Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXXXII, Carus and Sons. As the wild and crazy experiment of the 3rd century winds to a conclusion, a man named Carus steps into the purple, with an imperial dynasty ready to go. But Rome has grown unwieldy. Challenged by enemies from beyond and within, it will take quite a leader to hold the empire together. Here's Kaelin Davenport. Sorry, I just realised that my intro made it seem like I meant that Kaelin is the man who will hold the Roman Empire together. And don't get me wrong, much love to Kaelin, but Rome has something else in mind. Here's Kaelin Davenport. Sorry, look, I just did it again. Kaelin is not the man that Rome had in mind. Look, let's just start the podcast, shall we? Okay.
When Probus dies in the summer of 282, that's the Northern Hemisphere summer, the next emperor is his Praetorian prefect, Marcus Aurelius Carus. And there are two stories here. One, that Probus was killed by his troops because he was putting them to work on too much infrastructure. The other is that Carus actually rebelled. Probus sent his army against Carus, and then his troops defected to Carus and then murdered Probus. So one story is that Carus was involved. Another story is that he wasn't.
Okay. Likelihood?
I'd say it's pretty likely he was involved in some way, just looking at the pattern of the 3rd century. But, you know, that only happens also if, you know, there's resentment amongst the troops already. And, you know, Carus was Praetorian prefect as well, so he was travelling with the imperial retinue. He'd been known to the troops as well.
Okay. So when Probus dies and Carus becomes emperor, is there much rejoicing? Is this the sort of man who's embraced by Rome?
Well, the problem with Carus and his sons is they're the predecessors to Diocletian. And Diocletian, you know, founds what we call the Tetrarchy and does his best to blacken Carus and his sons, Numerian and Carinus. So you have to take that tradition into account as well. Certainly the HA says, you know, Probus was a good emperor and now we're stuck with these emperors, particularly Carinus, who is the final man who is defeated by Diocletian.
So he comes in already presenting Rome with a dynasty intact.
Exactly right. So he's probably about 60 years old, and he has two sons, the eldest, Carinus, probably in his early 30s, and then Numerianus, probably late 20s or about 30. And so Carinus is made Caesar almost immediately and then is raised the rank of Augustus at the beginning of 283. Numerianus is kept as Caesar. And the idea is that because you have this family, they can deal with the pressures that the empire is facing on multiple fronts. So Carinus stays in the west to deal with the incursions on the German frontier, and Carus and Numerian go east to confront the Persians. And so we still have the Persian Shahanshah, Bahram II. He is the person that Probus may have been dealing with, but Bahram II is actually being undermined within Persia because of rebellions by rivals. So there is a sort of a weakness there that Carus can take advantage of.
Okay, let's backtrack slightly. What do we know about Carus's background? Do we know that he's had a long military career?
It is probable, but we don't know the exact positions. He's a Gaul, which is quite interesting. So he's not from the Danubian region.
That doesn't happen often.
No, exactly. He's from Narbo, Gallia Narbonensis, so southern part of France. And, you know, to be Praetorian prefect, he would have been rising up through the equestrian military career ranks. Fun fact, his coinage shows that he's going bald. It's interesting. It's because I don't mention it in a frivolous way.
But usually they'd show the laurel wreath masking it.
But the laurel wreath, you see the laurel wreath on his coins, but it's also most of his head is notably bald. So he has the traditional male pattern baldness with hair around the sides. And then, you know, you see the wreath over the center. And a key anecdote about Carus, which actually comes from the early 5th century, actually revolves around his baldness.
Yeah, okay. Do we have that later on?
Yeah, we have this. Okay, okay, yes, all right. Yeah,
to be continued.
Yes.
But yeah, honesty and coinage.
Exactly. Once you notice it, you can't unsee it. It's everywhere.
Uh-huh. Okay. So the good thing about having, did you say two Augusti and a Caesar?
That's right. Yes.
The good thing about having that is you don't need to be in two places at once. You can delegate and you can trust your family better than you can just trust a general.
That is the idea about your dynastic succession. And this is something that Aurelian and Probus didn't have. This is something that shores up Carus's regime from the beginning. And so, you know, he and Numerian, his younger son, can head off to Syria by early 283. They're already at Antioch. They can be comforted by the fact that Carinus is dealing with things in the West.
Mm. So what do we know about the campaigns they're engaged in?
Well, we don't know too much detail, but we know it was incredibly successful. So they cross the Euphrates and then make it as far as the Tigris River. They manage to capture Seleucia on the west bank of the Tigris and then go to the east bank and they manage to capture the Persian capital of Ctesiphon. And they probably do that in the space of about 6 months. That's probably about June, July. That summer, they've captured the Persian capital and they take the title of Persicus Maximus. So I can't give you details of, you know, battle formations or anything like that because we don't know in that detail, but, you know, they swept over pretty quickly. So we do have an anecdote about the campaigns and it comes from Synesius, who is actually an ambassador to the court of Constantinople, which is being ruled by Arcadius in the late 4th and early 5th century. Mm. So we're forwarding, you know, well over 100 years. And Synesius delivers a speech called De Regno on Kingship to the Emperor Arcadius in order to show him how an emperor is supposed to behave.
Oh,
yes, I know. Who doesn't want to hear about how you're supposed to rule?
I'm going to tell you how to do your job.
Well, there's this debate that he probably didn't actually deliver it. It was just written out of a fit of anger because Synesius is waiting to get an audience with Arcadius, and he never does. And, you know, he blames his eunuchs and, you know, the troops and everyone. And, you know, and in this speech, he talks about how good emperors are supposed to behave. But he has this quote about Carus. His name is given as Carinus, his son, but it is actually Carus because Carinus never traveled to the east. And a key feature of the story is that he's bald. So I'll quote from this. So now when he, the emperor, saw them, that is the Persian ambassadors, according to the story, he did not spring up, nor did he change anything. But he called out to these men from the very spot and said that he knew they had come to see him, for that he was Carus. And he bade them tell the young king, that is the Persian king, that very day, that unless he conducted himself wisely, he might expect that the whole of their forest and plain would be in a single month barer than the head of Carus. So, you know, I'll raise everything,
yeah.
Be barer than my head. And as he spoke, they say that he took off his cap and showed his head, which was no more hairy than the helmet lying at his side. And he gave them leave if they were hungry to attack the stewpot with him, but if not in need, he ordered them to depart at once and to leave Roman lines as their mission was at an end.
Okay.
So again, you know, it's bald as the shiny helmet next to him as well.
But I can see why, you know, this is a good leader. You're showing humility, your awareness of your own faults. You can crack a good joke and have a prop handy. But also you're offering your men a meal before they run off.
Yep, it's the ideal king there.
You are not keeping him waiting.
Yes, exactly. Synesius goes on and say, now it is said that when these messages were reported to the rank and file and to the leader of the Persians, everything that had been seen and heard, at once, as might have been expected, shuddering and fear fell upon everyone at the thought of fighting men such as these, whose very king was neither ashamed of being king nor of being bald, and who, offering them a stew pot, invited them to share his meal. And their braggart king, so the king of Persia, arrived in a state of terror and was ready to yield in everything, he of the tiara and the robes, to one in a simple woolen tunic and cap.
Mm.
So this is, you know, the Persian, you know, love of ceremony, of finery, which, you know, Roman emperors had as well at this stage, but it's, you know, it's a stereotype of the Persians. And, you know, all this sort of ceremony is going to be useless when confronted with a leader like Carus.
Okay. Well, if any of it's true, that sounds like good qualities to have in an emperor who is unfortunately quite short-lived, which we'll get to shortly.
That's right.
But tangent note, that sounds like a great speech.
Yeah.
Is there a lot of good material in
it? Oh, yeah, it's really good. So when in about 10 years we get up to, you know, the 5th century, I'll tell you more about it, because it, you know, he talks about, you know, the barbarization of the Roman army and how there's too many foreigners fighting in there. And, yeah, it's a real rant about the current state of the times, which is why it could never have actually been delivered into the Emperor Arcadius.
Yeah.
He compares the Emperor Arcadius to a jellyfish sitting inside his palace.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, that never got to the emperor.
Yeah.
It was an angry letter to the newspaper kind of thing, a letter to the editor.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So Carus dies, very short-lived. So what happens?
Yes. So he dies while on campaign, shortly after they've captured Ctesiphon, so probably about August 283. I love this death, you know. It is
That's not
great.
Something that you hear very often.
He is struck by lightning and he is fried alive.
Wow.
This is in Eutropius. It is Zonaras in our Greek tradition. Aurelius Victor gives the thunderbolt story as well, but says he earned divine wrath because he not only captured Ctesiphon, but he also wanted to advance further east, you know, to emulate Alexander the Great, go all the way to India. And the gods said, no, that's too far. And, you know, they struck him with the thunderbolt.
Wow. Okay. So that's in quite a few sources.
Yeah. It's pretty consistent. The Historia Augusta says there was a storm and he was already ill in the storm, lightning and thunder, and he just passed away during that. But I like the story is that, you know, you see the thunderbolt coming down from the heavens and, you know, striking his tent and he's holding a metal pole or something. And, you know.
That metal pole. Sure. I mean, I like that story too.
Yeah.
And it's not often that I say this, but Historia Augusta has the most plausible one there. The most plausible death. The most mundane but plausible. You're
exactly right. Yes, the HA is more plausible. David Potter has argued that even the lightning story is implausible, and he has said that it's probably the soldiers who rebelled and threw fire at his tent and burned him alive. But I think that is a bit wrong, personally, as much as I respect David Potter's work, for anyone listening.
Hi, David. He leaves behind two sons. Carus has got a dynasty.
That's right. And Numerian is there. He is in Persia. So Carinus, the eldest son, is off in the west. But Numerian is there on the scene. And, you know, he is known as an orator. This isn't just in the HA. He's known as a good public speaker. After Carus's death, Numerian is elevated to Augustus, there's no question. And he also seems to be married to an unnamed woman. We don't know who she is, but she is the daughter of the Praetorian prefect Flavius Appia. There's a marriage, hopefully there's going to be children, you know, that is going to continue. And so Numerian decides, okay, with the death of his father, we can't go any further. And he withdraws from Persia and they head back east. You know, they travel through Syria, overland through Asia Minor. And when they're getting close to, you know, the Bosphorus, where Byzantium is, the story goes that he has eye problems. And so Numerian decides to now ride in a litter that is closed. But then after a few days, the litter starts to smell. This rather putrid smell comes out of the litter. They draw back the litter and they find that Numerian is dead. So here I need to introduce another person, and this is Valerius Diocles, who is the commander of the imperial bodyguard, what is called the Protectores Domestici. So Appia is the Praetorian prefect in charge of all the Praetorian guard, and Diocles is another high-ranking commander, but not as high as Appia. And so Diocles says that Numerian was killed by Appia, who had been concealing him from everyone. And Diocles challenges Appia to a duel and promptly kills him very close to the city of Nicomedia. And then Diocles is proclaimed emperor on the 20th of November, 284.
There's a lot that is problematic with that story. What I kind of don't really buy in this is that Numerian can be dead and unattended for so long that he starts smelling in the litter.
Yes, yes. This story is certainly infected, sorry if I can use that terrible pun, with Diocletianic propaganda, which blames Appa as a traitor, that it was his fault. It's a great story. I love the fact, you know, the emperor hasn't been seen for days, you know. They draw back the curtain. Ah, he's dead.
Yeah, but nobody was bringing him a glass of water, you know?
Yeah.
Still asleep? Okay.
Still asleep, yes. Oh, we should leave him alone. Yes, yeah. It's a great story, and it enables Diocletian not to be an emperor killer himself.
Okay, all right. So while he's got the plausible deniability there, I guess there's a chance he could be implicated. Who knows? We're never going to know. But there is still an emperor.
Carinus in the West.
This gets back to what I'm saying too much now. A usurper is simply an emperor who hasn't won.
that's completely right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And one thing we'll talk about Diocletian is how easily he could have been dethroned in the early years.
Yeah.
And so we might be telling a very different story of Roman history. Yes, in many ways, most Roman emperors were actually usurpers.
Yeah.
So yes, Carinus is still often in the West. He's married to a woman with the wonderful title of Magna Urbica. His son, Nigrinianus, seems to have died young and been deified. But he's in battle against the Quadi in 283. He celebrates a triumph over them in Milan. One of the features of the 3rd century is that emperors do not always return to Rome for triumphs. They can triumph in other cities as well.
Yeah.
And Milan, being in North Italy, is much more strategically located. You know, if you want to get quickly over the Alps to Germany, or you want to go back eastwards to the Danubian frontier, you know, and avoid having to go down to Rome and then back up again. So this is one of the reasons why Milan becomes so strategically important.
It's interesting how much Rome is falling. Just even in this kind of functionality of the empire.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's not close to a frontier, so that's problematic. Now, he also takes the title Britannicus Maximus, so greatest conqueror of Britain. Now, most of Britain is already conquered. What do we know about what he was doing there? So there's a poem written by a poet, Nemesianus. And this is great because, you know, we have some other form of literature which can help us illuminate what's going on here. So this is a poem called the Cynegetica, which is a hunting poem.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, you know, have this bit at the beginning, you know, praising the emperors. And this is written before Numerian had died, or before knowledge that Numerian had died got out to Nemesianus. And he proclaims in his poems, "Soon I shall gird myself with a better lyre to record your triumphs, sons of the most gallant deified Carus, and will sing of our coasts beneath the twin boundaries of the world, and the subjugation by the brother's divine spirit of the peoples that drink the Rhine and the Tigris, and the distant star of the Arar, and see the source of the Nile at its origin. Nor should I be silent about, first, the wars with which your successful hand lately completed under the North Star, Carinus, almost outstripping your divine parent." The war under the North Star, it's been suggested that is the British campaign. Mm. And we do know from about 4 years later that there are severe pirate raids on the coast of Gaul and Britain, so this could be the campaign there as well. But, you know, it shows how, you know, when poets are writing these things, they envisage a glorious future, you know, that both brothers are going to rule the empire from the Rhine to the Tigris, you know, from Gaul to the Nile and Britain as well, before it all comes crashing down.
Mm. Now, Carinus is the type of person who has got a very bad reputation if you're just going by what's in the Historia Augusta.
That's right.
He's kind of, I think, painted it as one of those bad emperor kind of vibes. But how much of that is propaganda? Because he's the emperor at this point, but Diocles is also claiming that title.
That's exactly right. And because he is eventually defeated, we only have, you know, the later version of propaganda. So Carinus is a dissolute emperor. He's incompetent. He engages in adultery, corrupts the youth sexually, you know, engages in homosexual love affairs, etc. He's supposed to have engaged in affairs with the wives of his own officers, all these things. You know, the HA, you know, has these ridiculous stories about him taking 9 wives in all and things like that.
Mm.
At one of his banquets, apparently he served 100 pounds of birds, 100 of fish, 1,000 of meat of different kinds. He lavished on his guests vast quantities of wine. He swam about among apples and melons and strewed his banqueting halls and bedrooms with roses from Milan. So, you know, these are stories like Nero, Vitellius, Elagabalus, you know, all those kind of things. He probably didn't have enough money to do all these, you know, extravagant things. He did face usurpations, for example. His Praetorian prefect, Marcus Aurelius Sabinus Iulianus, claimed power in Pannonia and was defeated in early 285. But then comes the confrontation with Diocles at the Battle of the River Margus in June, July of 285.
So by this point, Carus had been deceased by about 2 years, I think.
Yeah, Carus himself, Numerian, had been dead for about 6 months.
Yeah.
And Aurelius Victor says that Carinus actually won the battle. He says he put his enemy to flight. Diocles was actually defeated.
Mm.
However, he was killed by his officers because of his reputation for seducing their wives.
That feels tangential.
But why would it be remembered that
Diocles lost the battle?
Yeah, lost the battle.
Yeah.
But maybe he won and, you know, they killed him because they just thought he was such a bad emperor and they'd rather throw their lot in with the other guy.
Yeah.
There is a story that Aristobulus, who is a Praetorian prefect and is later kept in office and rewarded by Diocletian, actually helped to turn the tide against Carinus, so he may have been responsible for the final murder of Carinus.
Mm. So it's probably notable at this point to dwell on it just slightly, and I can hardly believe I'm saying this, but this is it for the Historia Augusta, our constant unreliable companion for the past, what, 100 years or so of Roman history.
Yes, he starts with Hadrian.
Wow. But I mean, you got other sources then, so you don't really go, let's see what Historia Augusta has to say about this.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, he's more reliable then. It all sort of turns bad in like the Severan period about Macrinus, Elagabalus,
yeah,
Severus Alexander, and then goes really bad from the middle decades of the third century.
Yeah. Yeah. But for quite a long time there, though, this is the most extensive history that we've had to rely on, as bad as it is.
That's exactly right, you know, yeah, because he does, you know, out of completeness, have biographies of virtually all the emperors. There is that gap, that lacuna that we talked about. For example, he doesn't have a life of Philip. I can update you on some latest research. I don't know if people remember.
Breaking news in the Roman history podcast.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember that I said there's this lacuna, you know, at the end of Gordian, you know, Philip, Trajan, Decius.
Okay.
And the manuscript is lost. And some scholars suggest that it was like a fake lacuna, a fake gap, fitting with the idea of a forgery.
Yeah.
But scholars looking at the manuscripts have actually said, no, it is a real gap.
Oh, okay.
So there is the HA's life of Philip, life of, you know, Trajan Decius, you know, Trebonianus Gallus out there to be...
Somewhere in a monastery.
Somewhere in a monastery, yeah, to be recovered.
Yeah.
So that's quite exciting. But yes, it has been our guide because it provides life-by-life accounts of the emperors and does provide more detail than some of these sort of later 4th-century epitomes like Aurelius Victor. And, you know, I have tried to point out when the HA gets things right, often because, you know, the details are found in other sources. But I've also tried to point out where I think, you know, we should treat things with extreme skepticism. And I think a lot of research on the Historia Augusta now is about looking at it as like a literary account, looking at a literary game, you know, trying to work out why it portrays things the way it is rather than trying to reconstruct when it's wrong and when it's right.
Mm.
One of the interesting things about the HA is that it does claim to be written by 6 authors living under Diocletian and Constantine. So there are these sort of flash forwards sometimes to Diocletian and Constantine. But the consensus now, and this is a pretty strong consensus, is that it is written in the late 4th century by one person who wished to portray himself as 6 different people.
Yeah. Just the fact that he decided to do that makes it sound like, you know, not a serious history, more of a literary exercise. If you're doing that, and pretending that we're six different authors, you're not really that worried with getting the record straight.
Yes, from the beginning, you know, you set it up as some sort of, you know, fraudulent work, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
The author says things like, oh, my grandfather was present when, you know, Numerian was found and, you know, Diocletian slew Appa and things like that. So, you know, he tries to insert himself into that kind of milieu. But I think that just fits in with his literary games to keep the audience guessing.
Yeah, okay.
But yes, goodbye, Stora Augusta.
I will miss it, but I won't.
That was Associate Professor Caelan Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any readily available podcatching platform. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on the decaying remains of Twitter. Caelan is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.